Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Sometimes historic events from 100 to 150 years ago can seem as if they occurred last week in the memories and opinions of those affected by them. And that was certainly what Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep found when he began researching the story of Indian removal. Strong opinions still exist to this day about the removal of the Chickasaw, Seminole, Choctaw, Creek, and of course the Cherokees to what would eventually become eastern Oklahoma. And Inskeep found that it's no accident that every state in those ancestral lands of those tribes have a Jackson County, a Jackson, Mississippi, or Jacksonville, Florida, named after the foremost force of Indian removal, General and President Andrew Jackson. Inskeep's book, Jacksonland, tells the story of the conflict between Jackson and Cherokee Chief John Ross, a man who turned not to violence, but spent 20 years fighting against the taking of Cherokee lands within the system, using the federal government to keep Cherokee lands whole. Then when the rules of the game changed and Indian policy changed, lobbying Congress, using the federal courts, courting public opinion, even engaging a small new women's movement to sway Jackson. But no Supreme Court decision or public sentiment would sway him, and the Cherokee's land was lost and the Trail of Tears commenced. Steve Inskeep is an award-winning journalist, the host of NPR's Morning Edition, and the author of Jacksonland, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and A Great American Land Grab. It's published by Penguin, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Steve Inskeep, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it's an honor to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. And as a journalist, I was interested in what attracted you to this story of Jackson's Indian removal policy and John Ross, the man who opposed him within the system, which is, I think, the most remarkable part of the story.
Well, thanks. That is what attracted me to it, even though I can't say that I understood fully the story at the beginning. I was researching the 1830s because of my day job. I was thinking about modern-day politics and how messed up it was, which kind of drove me back into history. I've been a kind of a student of history, self-taught, I guess you could say, although I have a degree in it, over the years. And I was reading about the 1830s and learning about the 1830s and became more and more interested in the story of this specific man who has been studied in history. There have been a couple of biographies of him, but I think not nearly enough done. And in many stories, he's just mentioned briefly. He's a minor character in some gigantic story of the Jacksonian era or of Andrew Jackson. But I got into this story, and it's just what you said. It's a man who did not fight an Indian war, did not believe that a rebellion could work, understood that his people were outnumbered. And so there he is. He's a minority in this rapidly evolving democracy. At the moment when the United States was becoming more democratic, and he began insisting on his rights within the system. And what's especially fascinating to me, Rich, is that before this time, there was the whole notion of protecting minorities. You know, majority rule, it's a democracy, but with protection of the rights of a minority. I think when the Founding Fathers thought of minorities, though, at the beginning, what they actually meant was the few rich people, the privileged people at the top, who wouldn't want to be outvoted by everybody else, so their rights had to be protected, especially their property rights. This was a different idea of minority rights. Ross was fighting for the rights of a few thousand people. It was maybe 15,000 Cherokees, depending on the date you want to look at, and their right to their land, which they were guaranteed under the law, but they relied on the faith of the United States government to come through for them.
Yeah. Getting back to how you started looking at this, what were the issues? What were the parallel issues? Was it nullification? I mean, because Jackson was dealing with nullification issues. And really, as you write in the book, he literally didn't have much of a choice once the events started unfolding by the time the Indian Removal Act comes around, because he would be looking at a rebellion from Georgia, you know?
Well, there was a problem there. And let's talk about a couple of the things that you mentioned. We're dealing with an issue where the United States was growing very rapidly. You had a very rapid spread of white settlement. You also had an increasing divide between North and South. This is the early, early prelude of the Civil War, even though no one could foresee really the Civil War and how awful it would be a couple of generations later. But all of that was happening. Andrew Jackson was a very strong figure as a president, particularly trying to manage the country and keep it together and deal with South Carolina, which was being extremely difficult and insisting on its right, as you said, to nullify federal law. He's dealing with all that, but at the same time, he has this problem with the state of Georgia, which, as many of your listeners will know intimately, was the heartland of the Cherokee Nation at that time. And so you have Andrew Jackson not wanting to push Georgia too far because it would, as you said, create another one of these sectional crises and potentially a civil war. But I have to say, that was also Andrew Jackson's inclination anyway. Something that I learned about Jackson that I just only hazily knew, didn't really understand until I got into this research, was that moving Native Americans off of their territories, particularly in the South, was a central project of this man's political life and his military life. He did it in 1814, he did it in 1816 and 1817, he did it a few years later again. He continued doing it. He was involved in real estate speculation. He and his friends would get a hold of chunks of former Cherokee land specifically and put plantations on it. And I document how many tens of thousands of acres that federal records show that they obtained after about 1818. This was a long-term project for this guy. And even if he wasn't forced by the sectional controversy, he may have gone in approximately the same direction.
In fact, that's where the title of the book comes from, Jackson Land. And you rightly point out that it's not for nothing that there's Jackson, Mississippi, Jacksonville, Florida. There's Jackson counties throughout Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia because he helped create the Deep South.
Yeah, and let's be fair to Andrew Jackson. For all of the awful things that we indict him for and that I think he deserves to be indicted for, he's a guy who helped to make the United States what it is. He altered the map of the United States. The entire state of Florida became part of the United States, partly because Andrew Jackson took an army and invaded it, perhaps without authorization and definitely without written orders, 1818, 1819. This is an incredible, incredible story. This guy changed the map of the United States. He's part of all of our heritage, even with the awful acts with which he is associated. And yeah, I mean, the Deep South, with its plantations or former plantations, with its incredible cultural power in the United States going up to today, its incredible political influence in the United States going up to today, he's the guy who got the real estate on which all of that was built. And it is a pretty amazing place to travel around today. And I should note, as your listeners are going to know really well, it's a land that today still, in spite of his best efforts, includes Cherokees and other Indians.
Right. You mentioned Jackson taking an army, a sort of an army he created, into Florida. This was history I did not know. It sounded like after the Creek War and the War of 1812, where he won the Battle of New Orleans, he pretty much had carte blanche in this area to do what he wanted to do. He was negotiating treaties. He was taking this militia army to enforce what he considered to be the law. He was sort of a law unto himself in a certain way.
Well, yeah, he was the military commander in the Department of the South, which effectively is what we now know as the Southern states. Some of them were states then, and some of them were territories. And yeah, he was an overwhelming power. He was even more of a power because of the way the federal government chose to do diplomacy. The government had recognized Indian nations as nations, because there just was no other way in international law to deal with them. You couldn't just pretend, although there was an effort made to do that, you couldn't just pretend that they were totally dependent. So the government recognized them as independent nations. They had to be dealt with through diplomacy. But then it was decided that the State Department wouldn't do the diplomacy. The Secretary of War would, the Defense Secretary of that time, which means that his man on the scene would be the man negotiating treaties. And that guy, after the War of 1812, was General Andrew Jackson. So, yeah, he was a treaty negotiator. He was an army commander. He was eager to get Florida from Spain, which owned it at that time. And he finally went in this very controversial invasion and ran up the American flag at the Spanish capital of Pensacola and started collecting taxes. He maintained in later years that he'd had some kind of quiet back channel permission given by James Monroe, who was the president at the time. There was no document saying this. He exceeded his written orders. He did what he wanted to do, and he did that again and again.
Now, you earlier mentioned his dealings in real estate. This is somewhat of a scandal. By today's standard, it would be an incredible scandal, and it seemed like it might have been a scandal if a certain records office hadn't burned down right before he ran for president.
Yeah. Now, this is absolutely true. There was an office associated with the Cyprus Land Company that burned right before his presidential election. Now, some of those records were reconstructed from memory. So who knows? Maybe we know it all, but I don't actually know what might have been burned there. This was a company started by his friends on land that Jackson had obtained from the Cherokees just north of the Tennessee River, and they created a city that's still there today, Florence, Alabama. And it's a gorgeous city. I loved visiting there. It's just so full of life and so beautiful and such a pleasant place to be and nice restaurants and just very scenic there by the Tennessee River. You got to give Jackson credit. They did something amazing there, but they did it in an appalling way. And part of that was grabbing this former Cherokee real estate, buying it low, selling it high. They were land speculators, and they were wildly successful at it, and they also colonized some of the area with their own plantations.
And that was the key area, too, that north bank of the Tennessee Valley, which belonged to the Cherokees. He thought he had it when he defeated the Creeks, and he was hoping to get that area. He was rebuffed at a couple of times, and he wanted that Tennessee Valley.
Yeah, yeah. This is all in his own correspondence, his own letters and letters that were written back to him. He had defeated the Creeks. He'd gotten most of what we now know as the state of Alabama, but that wasn't exactly the real estate that he wanted most. And so he got his best friend, John Coffey, appointed the official surveyor to mark out the territory that they were taking from the Creeks, and he insisted that it was going to just have to be a little bit larger than anybody else seemed to agree to, and that it was going to have to include a couple million acres on the south bank of the Tennessee River. And John Coffey went out and did that until he was blocked by none other than John Ross and a number of other Cherokees who were part of a delegation to Washington. Blocked temporarily, but Jackson was not a man to be blocked forever. And once he was stopped from just stealing the land, he was given authorization to go negotiate with the Cherokees to get that land. And a treaty was negotiated. Sequoia was one of the negotiators. The Cherokees at least didn't get the worst terms ever. They got to keep some of the land, and they got paid a fair amount of money. But they gave up more than a million acres, and it included, of course, the land that Jackson wanted most.
Yeah. And in fact, the chief negotiator was later murdered. Isn't that correct? The chief negotiator for the Cherokees?
I don't know that may have happened there. You may know more than I do.
There was
another negotiator, actually a chief and leader, Doublehead.
Yes, Doublehead.
Who sold a couple of huge, huge chunks of Tennessee to the United States. And, yeah, he was brutally murdered by allies, actually, of John Ross. It was felt that he had simply gone too far and enriched himself at the expense of the Cherokee Nation.
Now, the amazing thing about Ross and Jackson was that they had this relationship that went back 20 years prior to the actual time of Indian removal. Ross was a volunteer of a Cherokee contingent that fought the Creeks.
Yeah, this is maybe the moment when I began to feel like this is a story that needs to be told, the story of these two men, because they were on the same side and because the Cherokee Nation was on the same side. As Andrew Jackson, the Cherokee Nation was on the side of the United States. And I began to feel more deeply something that had always affected me when I was a kid in junior high school in Indiana, outside of Indianapolis. You know, I learned a page about the Trail of Tears, and there was this description of Indians who had assumed what was described as white man's clothing and taken on the white man's agriculture and farms and architecture, and they were in cabins and they were acting like white settlers, and there they were. And then these soldiers came out and rousted them out. And it was such an affecting story that stuck with me as a little kid. I think partly because it seemed so cruel, but also because it just seemed so strange and mysterious and not what I'd learned elsewhere up to that point. And now I begin to understand why all that was happening. The Cherokees were very savvy. And they understood that this vast, overwhelmingly white and democratic, increasingly democratic society was sweeping westward toward them, and they were going to need to adapt. I came to think of the Cherokees of that era as being like immigrants to a new country, except they were staying where they were and the new country was coming to them. Right. And so they were trying to assimilate, they were trying to adapt, and they were doing all these things, which were really quite clever and brilliant, trying to get the best of what they could from white culture while preserving their own independent identity and the parts of their culture that they wanted to keep, which makes this, to me, a really, really modern story. I mean, that's what we're all doing now, if we're thoughtful about it, is grabbing from different cultures while preserving what seems most valuable to us about our own. And this is what the Cherokees were doing at that moment, and they even, yes, supported militarily the United States in a time of war. And afterward, as you know, John Ross used that service. And he said, look, we fought for the United States. You should give us our rights. And sometimes that argument worked for him, but not in the end.
My guest today is Steve Inskeep, the host of NPR's Morning Edition and the author of Jacksonland, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and A Great American Land Grab. It's published by Penguin. It's a really interesting history for anybody who knows the history of the Cherokees. And he does detail John Ross's relationship with Jackson, the parallels. You have this one little incident where Ross is leading the light horse, I believe it's cavalry, it was an enforcement arm of the Cherokee Nation, and he's roused a white settler, and you said this was the fundamental difference between these two guys. Ross, when he's rousting this farmer named Atkinson off his land, he's like, let's burn everything, get off the land. He sees the guy as a poor guy just trying to make a living. He says, take your livestock with you. So this was the fundamental difference between Jackson. Jackson might have had those tendencies, but he would let his utter ruthlessness and the desire to completely defeat his opponent get the best of him. And Ross was a generous man at heart.
Well, I think that there was that difference between the two of them. Now, they were both just stubborn as mules when they believed that they were right. So they were alike in that way, but you've hit on something that was really moving to me and important to notice. There was this moment when Ross, who was very angry about white, I guess we'd call them squatters, they were called intruders at the time, white settlers who kept moving into the edges of Cherokee territory. He was very angry about them, but he couldn't take the fullest revenge against this guy. Andrew Jackson specifically believed if you were going to take out intruders at all, which he was reluctant to do, but if you're going to do it ruthlessly and kill their livestock. Because if they get to keep their livestock, they're just going to walk away from the farmland, wait till the soldiers leave and come back again. But Ross couldn't kill off this poor man's very, very limited life savings, so to speak, the few animals that he had. So he let the guy walk away. Now, you do wonder if Ross had been a little more brutal, a little more ruthless, like Andrew Jackson, would he have gone farther? Would he have had a chance to succeed? I don't know. Maybe he would have actually done. He would have actually done worse. You know, I discovered that when it got to the end of the story, when it got to the moments before the Trail of Tears in 1838, Ross discovered he had a hand to play, and that he could make demands of the federal government and get a better deal from the federal government if he would just go along in some limited way with the fact that Cherokees were to be removed. And he figured out a way to negotiate in that situation. I wonder if he was more stubborn, if he wouldn't have actually ended up in a worse situation and would have not been able to negotiate and get slightly better terms for his people.
Although, you know, the tide of the times was against these Indian tribes. You tell a story on Creek land about a Creek toll collector, a toll road, and white settlers move through and they don't pay the toll. He doubles back and has his only weapon, a pocket knife, and that gets conflated into an Indian attack.
Yeah.
All he wants is get the toll paid, and all of a sudden the papers are spreading Indian attack and militias are being put together to put down this Indian rebellion. That was the tenor of the times.
Yeah, it was a sad and tense moment, and one of the meanings I took away from that incident was that the white settlers of that time, although they were very proud of what they were doing and proud of the country they were expanding, they knew that on some level much of what they were doing was wrong. The way that they were going about it was wrong. And they were ready, I think, for that reason, for an Indian uprising, even in this case when there wasn't one, when it was one guy who was upset about an unpaid toll and he had a pocket knife.
Now let me ask you about Ross's basically resistance of government policy. Once the Indian Removal Act is signed, led by Georgians that wanted Cherokees out of Georgia, He comes up with a civil disobedience program. He's got women's groups lobbying on his behalf. It was really a remarkable story of the people opposed to Indian removal.
Yeah, and I feel that a lot of the tactics that he tried were tried later by African-American civil rights leaders. Now, that may seem strange for me to say. First, because John Ross himself was a slave owner, and we should not forget that fact. But second, because he was not as successful as they were later. He had to do all of this in a somewhat different country. But you're exactly right. He tried some of the same tactics. He concluded that war was not the answer, that violence was not the answer, that the way to demand his rights was through the law, that the thing to do was to fight in Congress, and having lost in Congress, to sue in the Supreme Court, and having lost in the Supreme Court, to sue again, and just keep going and keep insisting on their rights. And you said civil disobedience. That's exactly right. I realized after a while that maybe, Ross didn't know that term. He didn't use that term. If he'd been made familiar with it, maybe he would have changed it to civil obedience because he believed the law actually was on his side. They didn't have to disobey the law. They needed to obey the law and insist that the government obey its own laws. But what it came down to in the end was civil disobedience. The government said, you must leave by May 23rd, 1838. And the Cherokees didn't go anywhere. And my favorite detail is that they started planting, many people anyway, were seen planting corn crops in the spring of 1838 as if they still expected to be there in the fall. And it was a powerful thing. And it did not save them from removal, but it got them something. Ross, in Washington, negotiating with the government, had leverage because his people were refusing to leave, and the government realized they were going to have to force thousands of people across the country at bayonet point, and it was going to be a humanitarian disaster and look really bad for the United States. Mm-hmm. And they realized that they needed to negotiate with this man and give him terms that he had been denied. Cherokees got paid for their land, and they got paid more, thanks to Ross's negotiation at the very end. The money was not supposed to go to the Cherokee Nation's government. It did go to the Cherokee Nation's government because of Ross's negotiations at the end. The Trail of Tears was still a catastrophe. Let's not kid ourselves. But it was made better a little bit by that civil disobedience in the end. And the other thing that happened, because people stood in that way at the end, I think, is that it was marked for history. I mentioned earlier that I remembered this detail from elementary school. It's a thing you can get your brain around as a kid who knows nothing in central Indiana, which I certainly was. And you can get your brain around that. It happened because the Cherokees stayed there. They were nonviolent. They insisted on their rights. And they said, you can force us if you're going to force us, but you can't make us call it right, which is a thing that John Ross actually wrote in a letter at that time.
You mentioned the court cases he brought to the Supreme Court after the Indian Removal Act passed, and the most famous case is Worcester versus Georgia, where Chief Justice John Marshall held for the Cherokees that the U.S. government couldn't just seize the land. They had to negotiate with the Cherokees and purchase it. And, of course, Jackson's famous retort as president when that decision came down allegedly was, Justice Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it. Did he actually say that?
Well, I'm not sure that he did. Most historians think that that's a bit of a fabricated quote because it wasn't written down anywhere until decades later, and the source was one of Jackson's opponents. But I found some scholarship. It was not my scholarship, but there was a scholar some years ago who went through contemporary publications of the time and found four or five occasions where Andrew Jackson actually did say in real time approximately that. So he may never have said, quote, Justice Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it. But he said four or five other things that got into the papers and people's diaries and so forth at the time that meant about the same thing. I should mention that Jackson's actual behavior was a little different. He was angry about the decision. He didn't signal that he would obey the decision. But he realized after some time passed that he was going to create a constitutional crisis. And so he figured out this kind of political backdoor to make the whole lawsuit dissolve so that nobody had to deal with the full implications of it. And the suit sort of went away that way.
There's a picture in your book of some correspondence by Jackson. I think it's 1838, the year of the removal. And it says, why are we still dealing with this scamp Ross?
One of my favorite letters of all time. because he keeps writing until he's out of room on the page. And he's so angry. And it's because at the end, John Ross got a little piece of him. John Ross got something. And I felt like there's just a little flake of justice in that letter. It's a defeat for the Cherokees, but not quite a total defeat. And Jackson, at the very end, knows it.
I was really moved by some of the documents you reproduce in the book. One was a letter, as this was all heating up, Ross sends a letter to Jackson mentioning the fact that, you know, they'd had this 20-year relationship. He said, it begins 20 years have now elapsed since we participated with you in the toils and dangers of war, and ends with, now in these days of profound peace, why would the gallant soldiers which in time of war walked hand in hand through blood and carnage be not still friends? We answer that we are yet your friends. That must have been really moving to see that for the first time.
Yeah, and to think about what it meant, that it wasn't just rhetoric, that it was by then a desperate man who was running out of options, who was saying to Jackson, you were my comrade in war, come on. And he makes an extraordinary offer in that extraordinary letter. It's 1834, so it's getting pretty late. The Cherokees don't have many choices left. And Ross actually says, how about if we give you some of our territory, just not all of it? And we'll even get ourselves on a path to become United States citizens, which conceivably meant the end of the Cherokee Nation as it had been known up to that time. So he was putting everything on the table just to get to keep some of the real estate for a while. And even that was unacceptable to Jackson. What Jackson wanted and strategically felt that he needed was for everybody just to go west. It's a powerful and moving letter.
And you actually said there might have been some other solutions to removal. It may have been something like creating a county in Georgia where the Cherokees might have had some autonomy and eventually would sort of assimilate into the rest of the state.
Yeah, but we should be fair to the time and even to Jackson and acknowledge the truth of something that you said earlier. The other options were not so good. You're right. It's conceivable there could have been a Cherokee county in North Georgia that could have been a Cherokee homeland where the Cherokees would have their county seat of New Echota, which was their national capital. But that would assume a Georgia that was willing to accord equal rights to Indians, which just wasn't in the cards. They'd passed all these racist laws, openly racist laws. I'm not even calling names. That's what they were. And it just was not going to happen. There was another scenario, which John Ross sometimes discussed, of the Cherokee Nation, which spread across several existing states, could become its own federal territory or state. There was a precedent for that. There was a time in the United States where new states were several times created out of older states. But again, that would have required a much broader acceptance of Indians, of Native Americans, as equal human beings, in order for the broader U.S. government to get behind that kind of idea. And even that might not have worked for the Cherokees, because if you're going to become a U.S. state, then you've got to let anybody in, including white settlers, and pretty soon the Cherokees are outnumbered and there's no Cherokee Nation. I mean, there was no easy solution. There was one alternative which was discussed at the time, which was just go on with the old policy, which was the federal government is supposed to protect the Cherokees where they are in the status they already have under the treaties that have already been signed. That, though, would have been a really hard policy because of the constant pressure of white settlement. There were no easy alternatives, but we can imagine alternatives.
Mm. Well, it's a really interesting book, Jackson Land. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. I've enjoyed this talk.
Steve Inskeep is the host of NPR's Morning Edition and the author of Jackson Land, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and a Great American Land Grab. It's published by Penguin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.